Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. If you've been unfortunate enough to join what she calls the Grief Club, chances are you've already encountered today's guest, Cariad Lloyd, through her conversation-changing, taboo-busting podcast, Griefcast, a much-needed place to talk about the many messy faces of grief. Cariad lost her dad, Peter, to pancreatic cancer when she was just 15. In the late 90s, nobody talked about death, let alone what it was like to join the Dead Dad Club in your mid-teens. Now she's written a funny, frank book about her experience, You Are Not Alone, A New Way to Grieve. And I guarantee that whether you're grieving or not, you'll find it helpful. Cariad is also a comedian, actor, improviser and writer who has appeared on Peep Show, Have I Got News For You and QI, amongst others. So whilst this episode is illuminating, it is far from sad, I promise.
We like to fix problems and we like to believe we're powerful and believe we're in control. And death is just a constant reminder that you have no control in this spike spinning piece of rock that you're standing on.
Cariad joined me to talk grief, how pregnancy, therapy and approaching 40 collided, doing the grief maths, why thinking about the future makes her twitchy, and how she feels about approaching the age her dad died. We also compared our inner goths and she advised me on how to ask your partner if they want to be buried or scattered. I listened to a podcast, I can't remember which one. It might have been the one with Emily Dean. And you were saying that you never knew how to start. And I loved you for saying that because I never know how to start either. I'm always...
I know, it's so hard, isn't it? Because like you'll have a chat and then you're just saying, oh, I have to start like work. It feels like you're being like, oh, sorry, now we have to like do the work bit. I'm happy to start as awkwardly as we both want to.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, thank you for coming on the show. Yeah. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Yesterday I posted about the book. I posted a story on Instagram about You're Not Alone. I can't tell you what a massive response I had. It was absolutely
that's nice.
Crazy. I mean, people telling me how much difference you and Griefcast had already made to their lives.
Aww.
People like telling me their grief story. You must get this all the time, but people telling me their grief stories or people close to them's grief stories and like... Someone asked my advice about whether the book would be good for their mum. And I was like, I don't know, because I don't know your mum. But
sorry.
It's a really great book.
Sorry, babes. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because we don't talk about grief enough, whenever somebody sort of raises the flag above their social media platform and it's like, oh, I don't mind, I'll mention it, then the people who are so desperate to talk about grief are like, oh my god, someone I've got this thing to tell you, because the rest of society often closes the door and is like, no, we don't really want you to talk about it. So I think there is a real like thirst for when someone is like, oh, I've read a book about death, everyone's like Let me tell you my story. Because there's no other space for it.
Yeah. Tell us about how it started.
So my dad died when I was 15 in 1998 of pancreatic cancer. And I spent a long time talking about it with people, but kind of like, you know, finding people at a party and somebody might be like, oh, my so-and-so just died. And me being like, oh, my God, can we talk about it? Can we talk? Because I didn't know what to do. I wanted to talk about it. There wasn't anywhere to talk about it. And in 2016, that's when podcasts were becoming a thing and comedians were the only people really doing them. It was like, oh, another place to be funny. So all my friends suddenly got a podcast. And I was walking along the road and I thought, oh, if I was going to do one, I'd just talk to people about death. And then I laughed to myself out loud and I thought, like, nobody would ever listen to that. And it just kept, you know, an idea that it just wouldn't go away. So I recorded 4 conversations with essentially comedian friends who I knew had lost someone quite important and were already talking about it. So that was Adam Buxton, Jade Adams, Sarah Pascoe, and a producer called John Harvey. And then I just put them out there and I thought, well, that's good. The idea's done. I don't have to think about it anymore. So I've done it. Tick, next thing. And then just started getting hundreds of emails from people saying, I didn't know anyone else felt like this. I didn't know anyone else was grieving like this. I thought I had a breakdown, but what you're describing is just grief. You know, I've never told my partner how my father died, but I'm desperate to talk about it. And I suddenly, as 2017 rolled around, was like, oh, I've made a job. This is needed. And I didn't know it was needed. I thought it was just me. But I felt this kind of, I mean, it sounds silly, but I felt like a calling of like, I have to do this now. This isn't just me that wants to talk about it. So I started the Griefcast. And then here we are, 2023, and I'm on my 10th season. I've nearly done 200 episodes. And yeah, and now I've written a book based on what I've learned from the conversations.
Were you worried about becoming Queen Death, I think, as you put it?
Some of the listeners jokingly call me Queen Grief.
Queen Grief, sorry.
I'm not. Because, yeah. No,
it made you sound like Anne Rice, didn't I, then? Sorry.
Well, I'm an ex-goth, so, like, I'm happy with that. Like, you know, Monica doesn't bother me. I'm like, oh, no, I'm all sunshine. I'm like, no, yeah, that is my life. The inner me has, like, black lipstick and black nail varnish on in the corner, chain smoky and being sarcastic. Not chain smoking anymore, guys. I quit. So I don't think you can ever really be Queen Grief because every grief is different. And so although I have a lot of experience with my grief and talking to people, I fully admit if I suffered another huge loss, obviously touch wood, I don't do that for a very long time, I would be blindsided by it. So, you know, you can never protect yourself from grief. You can never be like, well, now I've got it. I understand it. I'll never be affected by it. But I certainly don't mind being the person who's willing to talk about it because I want to. I wanted to and nobody would talk to me. So I really understand that need to have this expression of this sadness, this massive thing that happened to you and feel like everyone in the world is acting like, oh, don't talk about it. Like it's eating your mouth full or something. Like it's really gross. And you're like, but it happened. Like, why will no one let me express this? So it's a moniker I don't really believe in, but I'm also happy to joke about.
I just have to say, I'm so happy to discover that you're a part of the Secret Teen Goth Club too, because I love coming across fellow kind of black nail varnish wearing, yeah, like dodgy black crimped monstrosity.
Oh, so much black eyeliner that it was just comedy, like how far it was trying to get to my temples. And I get annoyed now with goths now. You can Amazon stripy tights. Like in my day,
it was hard work.
So if you wanted to be weird, it was really difficult. Like you really had to try. I'd go out of your way to find these things. Like when I discovered blue lipstick randomly in the sale of H&M, like I was like, oh my God, this is my dream come true. And then I wore the blue lipstick and everyone laughed at me and bullied me for it. But I knew, like, I have tracked something weird down. So yeah, I'm definitely in that weird club.
Oh yeah, Miss Selfridge used to be my go-to because it actually had this floor with loads and loads of little crappy bits. And they did this kind of purpley grey lipstick that just made you look like you were already dead. It was a commitment being a goth.
Yeah, my niece now is very into alternative. And honestly, if she wants something, she just says, oh, can you Amazon for me? And I, it's like, oh, I can't believe, can't believe how easy it is to be weird these days. That's why I think there's more of them, because it is just genuinely easier. You really had to commit to it. But yeah, that's why, you know, I was already a goth and then my dad died. So I was already feeling like the world has this other side to it that's quite dark and depressing. And what does that mean? And then my dad died and I became like a really confident goth, because I was like, you know, there's other goths who are like, oh, I don't really know why I'm this sad. I was like, oh, I have a paid up fucking reason that I'm this sad. Here it is. I know death. I've seen someone die. Like the ultimate goth. Like, so it was a very natural progression for me.
I'm sorry, I don't quite know how to follow that. When you launched the podcast, you were pregnant, weren't you? And you were in your mid-30s. And you just started therapy.
Yes.
And I'm quite interested in how all those things intersect.
Yeah. Well, the way I live my life is I'm someone who claims that there's no connection to things. So I'd be like, oh, it's just random. Yes. It's just happened at the same time.
Right.
Absolutely
yeah.
Nothing to do with each other. I just, you know, therapist came through, started a podcast. And then about 5 years later, I go, oh, Carrie, there's probably quite a lot of connection. But I sort of don't like to think too much about what I'm doing sometimes, especially if it's a new idea. I'm like, don't think about it, just do it. I'd gone to my GP for stress, really. I knew something was wrong. I wouldn't have said it was grief. And eventually I did all this, like, what's the word? Jumping through hoops for the NHS, like taking all, you know, CBT and all this. But yeah. I kept saying to them, I think I need therapy. And they said, well, it's a 2-year waiting list. And I was like, my dad died when I was 15. I'll wait another 2 years. It's fine.
Yeah, I've already waited 20.
Yeah, it's like, it's absolutely no problem. So I waited and then I got this, you know, phone calls, your therapy place is here. And then I went for my first session of therapy. And then the next week I found out I was pregnant. So it was a bit, oh, all of this has happened at once. So I think the idea to talk about death publicly was only possible because I was in therapy and I was pregnant. And something happened to me when I was pregnant in that before I was pregnant, I did character comedy. I was an actor. I was like hiding. And all my comedy had grief behind it, but so hidden. You know, you wouldn't have known. It was all sort of leaking out in little drips. And then when I got pregnant, I felt this really strange thing. I was like, oh, I can't pretend anymore. Like I can't pretend to be, like I used to do this character called Joey Bechamel, which was like a fake Zoe Deschanel, manic pixie dream girl. And I used to put red lipstick and smear it all over my face and wear a pink dress. And I used to like come on and be like really cutesy and then be like, nose wrinkle, are you hard yet? To like a guy in the audience. And I just suddenly had this thing where I was like, oh, I just can't pretend. I can't keep it up. I can't pretend that this grief is not the thing I'm desperate to talk about. So, you know, I felt like I was ready, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It was like I couldn't hold it back anymore. And then when I had booked those 4 conversations with friends, with people I knew, and I think especially talking to, you know, Jade particularly, who'd lost her sister, and Adam, who'd lost his dad, John had lost his brother, and Sarah spoke about her grandfather. And just the way that we were, especially with Jade, I think, as well, it was like we were talking about like, oh, yes, me too. Oh my God, yeah, I felt like that. Mm. I just had this moment of like, oh my God, like my grief life had felt alone. It had felt completely alone. Like this really weird thing had happened to me. And talking to them, I was like, oh, fuck, we're not alone. Literally, like we all feel the same and we're just not talking about it. So I just had this moment of like, I've got to share this story. I've got to tell everybody. Like if you're grieving and you feel like you're the only person, you're not. There's loads of us. And which is why the book is called You Are Not Alone. And that's what I say at the end of every episode. I say, remember, you're not alone, because that's what grief makes you feel like. But I could only do that because of the therapy was supporting me. And at the same time as talking about it publicly, I was very privately breaking down, sobbing, being like, I've never told anyone all these things. And like, what happened to me? And yeah, having someone hold my hand through that process.
Why do you think it took you 20 years to have therapy? Because you had a little bit of therapy, hadn't you, which you write about extremely, is funnily a word? It's very funny.
Yeah, no, that's good. I hope so. It's supposed to be funny.
The
yeah.
scene in the book is very funny
intention.
About it, but you literally haven't had therapy since you were 15.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And again, you know, I must be clear, like I'm not a medical professional. I'm someone who's spoken to lots of people. So it's like learnt experience. But the thing that I have learned through talking to lots of members of the Teenage Grief Club, the TGC, as I call us, is we don't do it for ages. And, you know, I'm sure there's an academic that can tell you why, but in layman's terms, you're a teenager, this thing happens to you that like blows your world apart, and you don't have the vocabulary to deal with it. You have the emotions, but you don't know how to say, what does this mean? Who am I without my father? Like, you were living your life thinking, yeah, there's my parents, they're annoying, they're boring, I'm going away and do what I like. And then you're like, oh, nothing stable. And that can be, you know, it doesn't have to be grief, that could be a traumatic event as a teenager as well. And in your 20s, you kind of run away from it, because you're like, it's nothing to do with me. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's not important. Like, if people said to me, oh, your dad died. Yeah, it's no big deal. Yeah, dad's died. Like,
yeah.
I'm so blasé about it. And I ran away and ran away from the grief and from the feelings. And then in my 30s, which is, again, really common for TBC, all this stuff was going wrong. Like, physically, mentally, I had, like, severe anxiety, severe death anxiety. Like, you know, like, just really obvious stress problems if you looked at me. And I went to my GP with all these, like, oh, this weird stuff is happening. And he was like, do you think you might be stressed? And at that point, like, I'd done the Edinburgh Festival the year before, and I'd been like working on another show. I hadn't stopped. I was gigging like every single night of the week. And I thought, oh yeah, I guess it's stress. So it's a very common process to run away from it, because when you're a teenager and something happens, it's too big. And I think I had to literally mature and catch up with the feelings. You know, the feelings were adult feelings. They were feelings that you should be having age 35. That's when most people do start to encounter grief, you know, maybe earlier, later, but it's sort of more common. You know, you start getting to an age old, people's parents are getting sick and this happens. And it was like I caught up with myself, and I suddenly was like, oh shit, like I thought I dealt with it. I thought I was fine. I thought I was okay. And there was so much stuff. Like I said, I hadn't told people. I'd really kept a lot of it in. And I just thought, oh, okay, I'm ready. You know, I have a whole chapter in the book about therapy and how it saved me and how important it is. But I will always say it's really personal. And, you know, you've got to be privileged enough to work a system, which I was, and, you know, able to wait. Like I could wait. I wasn't an emergency case. But it really, really changed a lot of stuff. I try and be empathetic and sympathetic to myself. I used to think, oh, you should have gone earlier. And now I'm like, you just couldn't. You weren't ready.
No, so, you've got to be ready.
You know, you've got to be ready. And luckily, I lived long enough to deal with it. You know, like not everybody does. And even if something had happened to me beforehand, I don't think you would have said, oh, if only she'd dealt with that grief at 25. I was still fine. I was still basically fine. I just, there was sort of in the background this bubbling tornado, very bad metaphor, going on. So yeah, I think it's quite common for teenagers to wait that long.
Thinking of the number of women that I've spoken to on the shift who have, something has happened to them, maybe in their childhood or teens or very early 20s. And it does take, like, often until their 40s for them to reach a point where either their body screams, enough, like yours did, or something else happens that makes them go, do you know what, I need to talk to someone about this, or not even that conscious, really. And speaking personally as well, filling your life with stuff and just moving, moving as fast as you possibly can.
Moving, do not stop, keep working, change the job, find something else, just don't sit down, just never ever sit down. Yeah, that's how I lived.
I was really interested that you love the Lord of the Rings. I think that that's connected as well. I think that kind of like immersing yourself in a, you know, I love Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, or anything where I can just like vanish into somebody else's, some other, completely other world.
Yeah. You know, I've always been like that. I've always been a big reader, and I've always had this ability to disappear into things. And, you know, that's why I loved acting. That's why I loved improv. It was like, you disappear. You're not there. And all those voices and thoughts and that energy of like, what just happened to me? What's just... and you are in Lothlorien with the elves and everything's fine. The Lord of the Rings as well, the reason it became such a big thing in my family is that my dad was obsessed with it. So he used to read it to us, and he read us The Hobbit, and he had the tapes of like the Ian Holm Radio 4 audio version. He used to play in the car. So when they did the film of it, it very much for me and my brother became this like, well, this world is a world that dad knew. So it was, I guess, yeah, I haven't really thought about it, but should have put that in the book. It was almost like visiting with him, you know, he knew those characters. So yeah, the idea of disappearing into places, especially when you are feeling something so strong, and like you said, it can be any emotional traumatic experience, but grief, from my experience, is such a ball of emotions. It's everything, it's every single emotion at the same time firing towards you, and anywhere that takes you away from that for a second to breathe becomes so sacred to you.
It's like this kind of weird sense that, you know, you were 15 and in the space of 2 months you kind of became an instant adult, because you'd experienced this thing that really you need to be an adult, or maybe a very small child, to be able to deal with. But also, and this is a bit of a therapy thing, you kind of become a bit in stasis, if you know what I mean, that you kind of become like permanently 15, or for until you reach a point where you kind of deal with it.
Yeah, and I talk about that in the book. I call it like the freeze. And I've spoken to, again, a lot of people who lost people, I would say pre-20, and they will often, if I say to them, if you see someone of your age out and about, as in your age when this thing happened to you, do you feel like you you get them, like you can look at them and go, I know what's going on in your brain. And they'll be like, yeah. So if you're like, you're six or you're 10 or you're 15, if I see a 15-year-old girl, like I fucking get, I know what that brain is doing. Like my brain froze at that point completely. And I totally put myself in the freezer and was like, this person can never change or evolve because he knew this person.
Mm.
So I have to keep her and I will grow, of course, and do all these other things inside. I've got to make sure, keep her alive, keep remembering everything exactly as it was at 15. Don't let it like disappear. And I think that's what happened. I got to my mid-30s and I was like, I am not 15 and I can't keep pretending to be this 15-year-old. It's killing me. And when I got pregnant, I was like, oh shit, like, you know, you can get pregnant at 15, but I was not a 15-year-old who's going to do that. Mm. I was very young in myself. So it became this literal metaphor that I was not my father's daughter anymore. And I just want to caveat that if you don't know the show, a lot of people think that we had an amazing relationship and it sounds like, oh, he read me Lord of the Rings, it was lovely. We had a really bad relationship, like not great at all. And if we'd had a good relationship, I wouldn't need to do a podcast about it. I wouldn't need to write a book about it. I'd be fine. Mm-hmm. I'd be sad. And then I'd be like, well, okay. You know, we had such a complicated relationship. We didn't really get on, particularly at that point when I was 15. We really were like just not pals at all. So that's why I've ended up having to still process it. I worry that people think I sound like this daddy's princess or something. You know, that's why I'm still talking about it. It's like, no, it's actually the opposite. I think the daddy's princesses probably feel like, yeah, I was really loved and that was simple and now he's gone. That's very unfair. They're probably still very sad too.
Well, you talk a lot about the hierarchy of grief. And I think that one of the things I've come across a lot is people who've been estranged from people, you know, who've died.
Yeah.
And there's been this kind of idea that, well, you didn't like them anyway, so why does it matter? It's like, it doesn't really work like that.
It's so easy when you haven't experienced something to assume things. So you assume, oh, if you're not talking to your mum and they die, you won't be sad. When you actually say it out loud, you're like, well, of course you will be. Like,
yeah.
Like, and it will be complicated sadness. It won't be simple. It won't be like, oh, I loved her, she loved me. That's the sadness. But we have to get past this, I call it grief maths, that like... Mm. I can work out for you how sad you should be based on your relationship. So, you know, I've had people say to me, oh, you know, how long ago was it he died? And I'll say, oh, 20 something years. They go, oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Done then. Yeah.
Then they've done the maths in their head. Oh, 20 years ago is not bad. And we do the same with, you know, pregnancy loss as well. Like, well, how many weeks? Oh, you're 4 weeks. Oh, 4 weeks. How old were they? Oh, my granddad was 92. Well,
he had good innings,
or you were only a little bit pregnant. Like, we like to just like put these little maths in of like, well, that's, then you should be this sad, or I'm not going to have a really intense conversation with you, when actually, as I say in the book, and I only say this from talking to so many people, if you're sad, you're sad. You know what, there's people who have been estranged, someone has died, and they haven't been broken by it. They've been like, well, I said all I needed to say and it's fine. And there's people who are absolutely devastated, even though they hadn't spoken to him for 20 years. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There's not a logic to grief, because it's about a relationship and how you are emotionally, and that's a completely unique experience. So all you can do with grief is not judge yourself. Like, if you're sad, you're sad. If you're sad that a celebrity dies and it's broken you in two, you're sad. If you're sad that your cat has died and you are weeping more than you did for your grandma who died a month ago, if you're feeling it, you're feeling it. There's no point getting the list out and the tick, well, you shouldn't feel this and you shouldn't have this. And, you know, it's this, grief just doesn't work like that. Humans don't work like that.
I'm really, really guilty of this. It's like, what's the end point? You know, I'm the person who went to therapy, and practically the first thing I said to the therapist was like, how long is this going to take? You know, it's like...
How long we got?
Yeah,
I've got 6 months tops. Yeah,
yeah, come on. Exactly.
I will work hard. I'm going to turn up every session. I'll do my homework, but then I'm done, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's partly because, well, whether it's partly capitalism in it, but also it's easier, isn't it? It's easier for other people if you can go, oh, well, 20 years. That's ages ago. Yeah.
That's the thing you have to remember with grief. So much of when we talk about it publicly or with, you know, people you know, it's about the other person, not the griever.
Mm.
So that conversation, if someone says to me, how long ago did you die? 20 plus years. Oh, all right, 20 plus. What they're saying is, oh, phew, I don't have to have a massive chat with you because you probably won't be that sad.
Yeah,
like, that's what it is. And that's fine. But it's like, it's quite rude when you can hear the subtext, and everyone can hear the subtext. So it's that thing of thinking, instead of thinking, oh, 20 plus years, it's instead of you assuming a reaction for me, you could ask, oh, you know, how do you feel at 20 plus years? That is a long time, but I wonder, are you still sad? And I would say, yeah, sometimes, but like not every day. And my life's pretty good. It just, you know, grief stays with you forever. It'll always be a sad thing that happened. Like that's, you've heard me. I feel heard. I feel like you're not like writing off my, you know, life's years of pain. And I talk about this in the book, like this is why I hate the five stages, is the five stages theory of grief. Humans want an ending. We want beginning, middle, end. Like we are obsessed with stories. We're obsessed with narrative. We like watching the film and the two people turn up and then they have a row, but they like each other. And then they have another row, but they seem to like each other. Oh, they get together at the end. Like we love that. We feel, I can
relax. It's like we need it.
We need to believe it's a possibility, but we also need to acknowledge it's not what real life looks like. Like with rom-coms, like we all know that's not what real romance looks like. That's not what real relationships end up looking like. That's a moment of a relationship. And we have that kind of ability to go, oh, that's Hollywood and here's real life. But with grief, I feel like we're behind and we're like, no, grief should be, I feel sad, I cry, I go to therapy, what, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, I'm fine. Come on, I'll give you two. And it isn't like that. It doesn't work like that. That's not how your brain works. That's not how emotions work. You know, my dad was my dad for 15 years and he'll always have been my dad. So that's a lifelong process. So even after 2 years of grief, why did I think I should be over it? That's not enough time for how long he really was physically here for me. And I'm 50% of him. So I'm always going to have that voice in my head and relate to him and think, what would he have thought about this? That's never a conversation that will disappear. So therefore, I'm always going to be grieving him in new ways as I change, as I age, as I develop. But that doesn't mean there's no ending. That just means the grief evolves with me. So you have to reframe it in your brain, because I think people hear no ending and they feel sick. They're like, oh my God, I'm going to feel like this forever. And you're like, no, you're not going to feel like this forever. In the same way that when you fall in love with someone, you don't feel like that forever. It changes, it grows, you develop something.
Yeah, and you accept that. And expect it.
And you accept it. But with grief, we're like, this feeling is unbearable and it needs to stop. And what can I do to make it stop?
You know, there are always going to be like big moments, aren't there? However long ago it was, whether it's the point where he's been dead for longer than he was your dad alive.
Yeah.
Or the point like when you were pregnant and you write incredibly movingly about the moment in the playground with your daughter, with the granddad.
Seeing granddad, yeah, that's my trigger at the moment, is seeing granddad, because that's something, obviously, when I was 15, it didn't bother me, I didn't understand. When I was in my mid-20s, I wouldn't see a granddad and think, oh, well, my kids won't have a granddad, because you might think it, but it didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's only when you have a child, you're in the playground, and some, you know, silver-headed, cool London grandpa is pushing their kid and mucking around, you're like, oh, I don't have that, do I? I didn't get that. And then you realise, oh, not only do I not get that, my kid doesn't get that. And you want your kid to have everything you had and you want them to have as much as possible. So you think, oh no.
Here we go.
But as I say in the book, you know, because I'm 20 plus years in, what the superpower that I have, I don't think grief is a superpower, but I think like the superpower that can come with grief over time is that I can recognize that pain. Oh, my daughter doesn't have a grandpa. I had a grandpa and he was like one of my favorite people. Okay, that's sad. Let's just sit with that for a bit. What does she have? She has an amazing grandma. My grandma was like, didn't really want to speak to me ever. So, okay, well, she's having a different childhood to me and she's having a different experience, but it's not better or worse. It's just different. And there's a sadness to that and there's a joy to that. And both of those things exist in the same place. And as long as you let yourself feel a bit of both of them, you can, you know, you can walk through it. And that moment for me when I saw him, the granddad, it was very sad. And I felt sad for like a couple of days, but then I was okay again. And it's like, you just let it come into your life, feel it, let it go out again. And that's what I mean. The experience I have from grief is that I now know it's not going to be here permanently. It never is. You never feel something constantly. You know, your emotions change all the time. So the grief comes, it's shit, it stays with you, sits on you, and then it goes. Because it's not, you know, it's not depression. It's not a mental illness. It's the deep, deep feeling of loss that something you used to have is not here anymore. So it can come and go at will, which is terrifying. Like, you don't know when it's going to turn up. And it's not always the big things, you know. It's not always the birthdays or anniversaries. Sometimes I quote lots of people in the book from the show, like Reverend Richard Cole has really stuck with me of saying, like, you know, sometimes it's their parmesan in Sainsbury's, like, just in pieces because they liked that parmesan. Like, so that's the thing. You never know when it's going to jump out at you. but the longer you do this process, the more you trust it will pass. It will pass.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I just think we're just not very comfortable. We're not like brought up to be. Society isn't very comfortable with any negative emotion.
No.
Oh, it's no. Like, and all the things that, you know, can go with grief, like anger and guilt and rage, and they're just not emotions that we're encouraged to experience anyway, particularly anger.
Yeah, and it's a huge part of grief. Yeah, so I write about that, like I was angry for years. That was my main emotion, was fury. Just absolutely furious. And yeah, you know, take a teenage girl who's already angry at the world and give her a reason to be angry. I mean, you don't want to mess with her and you don't want to look at her. She's like, she got an answer for everything. And I think I completely agree with you. What we see as negative emotions, it's interesting, even that word.
Yeah.
But what we mean is they don't feel nice. Like, to be angry doesn't feel that nice. To be depressed or sad or crying so much that you're like making a weird noise because you're not even crying anymore, you're just like honking. It doesn't feel great. And so we go, oh, this is bad. I don't feel good. It's bad. Rather than like, well, this is part of it. Like, I miss them. I can't not miss them. Like, that's the thing with grief. Like, we're trying to make it okay or make it like a positive experience. And it's like, it's not negative or positive. It's just is what it is. It's very, very sad. And there's some positive bits and some negative bits, but it's extraordinarily sad that somebody you loved isn't there anymore at all and is unreachable. And I think we find that really hard because most things, you know, it's the one thing in our life that's so definite, so final. With, you know, most stuff isn't. Most stuff, there is ways around things. You can read or research or talk your way, somehow find... But you can't. When someone's dead, they're dead. That's it. That makes us angry. Because we like to fix problems and we like to believe we're powerful and believe we're in control. And death is just a constant reminder that you have no control in this like spinning piece of rock that you're standing on.
Yeah, the constant proof of our impotence. So.
Yeah, yeah. And that's hard. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to navigate, because it isn't. You know, we're all here. We all know people who've died. We're all surviving, getting up in the morning. So, you know, you can exist with it, but it's hard to be reminded of it, and it's hard to be very close to that feeling, especially the first year of grief. I always say the first year is very tough to be that close to those feelings, to have them that loudly in your head. It's really hard, really, really hard. And so we have to be kind to ourselves and go, I've just got to feel this, like I can't run away from it.
Do you come from a family of talkers, or do you come from one of those families that just like keep the lid on the can of worms and the can of worms will stay over there and everything will be fine?
I come from, how can I describe this? I come from like, I would describe as an unusual niche of the talking section.
Yeah.
in that I, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, we talk about everything. And I think we're sort of talkers who are very choosy about what we talk about. So I definitely don't come from a repressed family at all. Not at all. Like, I would say too much the other way. What's the opposite of repressed? Not pressed. Like, I want another word. Everything's on the table. My dad was an extremely emotive person. You knew he was in the room, and he made us have family meetings from the age when I was 4 years old. I would have family meetings. Every Sunday, get your diaries out, guys. What's happening? Who's doing what? What's your goals for the year? What's your objectives? Like, from four.
Really? Oh my God.
And they were both into very, like, my mum, you know, my mum sort of counters it like he was more into it. She was a bit like, she was into it, but she was always a bit like, yes. So, you know, I'd also quite like to watch telly and have a sit down. But they were into like self-help, extreme self-help, kind of like courses. And, you know, we went to a hippie commune at one point, or like an alternative life commune in Scotland called Fintorn, which I'm sure some people have heard of. So they were really, really big talkers, and I felt like I could say anything, and, you know, hence why I am such a, you probably gathered, extremely talkative person. And I expressed myself very verbally. And then when he got sick, he didn't want to talk. And that was so confusing to me, of like, but all we do is talk. And that's when I realized, oh, we talk about positive things, like what we're going to do and how we're going to achieve stuff. We don't talk about uncomfortable emotions. Uh-huh. Like, and that was a really hard lesson, because you're like, but you've, you know, like, I've been brought up with this politics of talking. Like, that's what we do. That's how you solve. And then when something negative came in, it was like, well, no, this is too painful to talk about. And I was like, I thought nothing was too painful to talk about.
Yeah.
So that was understandable from his point of view, but hard to deal with from my point of view. And, you know, he was diagnosed in February. He was dead by the April. So perhaps he would have talked had he lived longer. But he, you know, he just kept saying, I'm fine. I'm going to be fine. Positive thinking. Like, we'll get there. And, you know, he was trying lots of alternatives. And, you know, he went medical. He had chemotherapy and all the rest of it. But he was trying everything. And it was all about getting well, getting better. He wanted that conversation. But if you said, well, should we think about your funeral? It was like, no, because it's not going to happen. And you're looking at this person, he's like bright yellow, lost 2 stone, is in a cancer ward, and you're thinking, I don't think you are going to get better. But I'm only 15, so if you say you are, like, maybe you are. I don't know, I'm the child here. So it was a very confusing time. I have a really vivid memory of my mum and me sitting trying to plan. Like, she kept saying, like, Pete, please, like, just let's just start thinking. She's a very practical person. She knew she's gonna have to make some decisions. And he said to me, get a pen and paper. Right, we need to book the flights to Boston. That's where I'm gonna go next week. Then we need to go here. We're gonna go and see this person. They, you know, and I was like, what? Like,
was he on a lot of drugs at that point as well?
I mean, yeah, my therapist said the same thing. I imagine he was. It's hard to know. He must have been. And we also think, like, it spread so quickly. So I don't know what state his brain was in, to be honest. Like, it had spread all over his body very, very quickly. But he just was that. He was a real, I mean, God bless him. Like, he was a real positive doer. Like, his whole life, any problem, he'd fixed it. He'd solved it. He like, drove through life. Like, he was a very extreme. And some people loved him for it. Like, if you got on board his train, you were going somewhere exciting. And some people would be like, this man is too much, and really, what the fuck is he doing? But if you believed him, it was amazing. And so I think when it came to his cancer, he just was like, no, I've defeated everything, every problem. I've taught my way out of it. I've worked my way through. And yeah, he hit the ultimate problem. So it was, I can see now as a grown up how hard that must have been for him. And it took me a long time to see it from his point of view, because I just was locked, frozen, as we said, in the 15-year-old, of like, well, why didn't you talk to me? Why didn't you help me? And now I'm like, oh, he couldn't even help himself. Like, he was a flawed human being, as we all are. He did his best.
How did it affect your relationship with your mum?
We already had a very good relationship. And I think both me and my brother would say, like, we say this on the show, and I think this is something, if you're not in the grief club, it sounds really awful, but like, how can I say this? I'm not glad he died, but like, if it'd been the other way, I don't know what would have happened to us. Like, he was not a practical, reliable person. So in terms of like a partnership, the extreme fireworks person died, and the person, like, the solid, there for you, make sure you have your breakfast, you got clean clothes, you go to school, like, that person was still there. So we were very lucky in that way, because we had a really, really stable life after the death, which is a really big if you speak to Child Bereavement UK, like that's a huge factor in mental health for teenagers or young people who are bereaved, is that the other parent to be stable and consistent and, you know, offer all the things that the death has taken. So yeah, I have a very good relationship with her because we went through this huge thing together. And, you know, my brother was 19 at the time. So it bonded us in a very, very tight way. And I think that we spent the rest of our 20s and 30s having to like unweld ourselves like, oh, actually we need to be individuals, like we can't be this incredibly tight unit, because we really went through it. And my dad being the person that he was, this huge character, you know, when you lose a sibling you lose a witness, so you lose a witness to your childhood. And that's what I have still with my brother and my mom, that I can say, do you remember when he did this? And they're like, yeah, because he was really weird and he did some really strange things. And you know, so it's very helpful to have that unit afterwards to be like, did I imagine that, you know, we once went to someone's house who he didn't, when we got there, he actually didn't know them because he'd made a mistake of like remembering faces, and we all had to have dinner party with someone. My dad had no idea who this man was. And he told us, they left to make drinks and he said, I don't know who this is. He met someone at a conference, got the wrong business card, stuff like that. We were just like, I just need someone to remember that the things he made us do sometimes. Like, did we all go to that commune? Yes, we did. Okay, fine.
Fascinating. You've said, I think, that you're not very good at thinking about the future. Why do you think that is?
So, again, very common symptom. I hate to be sort of so textbook. I'd rather be the unusual goth person, but I'm actually quite normal. When you lose someone very young, you learn not to trust things, and you learn not to trust the future because the rug got pulled out from underneath you. And we call it on the show death anxiety, and anyone can experience it, but I definitely notice the younger you are, the sort of worse it is. And it tends to happen to women quite a lot after they've had children. So I've had friends say to me, oh my God, I can't stop thinking about dying, and I can't stop thinking like something happened to them or me. And I find it really interesting because I'm like, wow, that's been my life since I was 15. And I think it's just when it tends to happen to people after they have kids, when they're like, oh gosh, we're all quite vulnerable. Whereas when you lose your dad at 15, you learn that lesson just way earlier than other people. So yeah, thinking about the future still makes me incredibly nervous because I think it's really arrogant to think there is a future. Like I just when people say, like somebody said, oh, you know, when we're grandparents, to me the other day at the playground, they were like, oh, well, you know, when we're the grandparents. And I thought, wow, the arrogance that you think.
Yeah.
Wow, that is bold. Because to me, like, if we get to be there, like if we get to see them grow up, like that.
Yeah.
And I wish it wasn't that way because it is a bit morbid. But your brain is, you know, quite malleable as a teenager, and neural pathways get formed and frozen. And so when somebody who's fit and healthy, who runs marathons, triathlons, is training for an Ironman, gets cancer and dies in 3 months, it's very hard to go, oh, well, you know, people won't die and everyone will be okay as long as you take care of yourself. And my therapist used to say to me all the time, well, you know, not everyone dies. It's like, you know, trying to help me with this concept that everyone's going to die. And I was like, yeah, but someone did.
Yeah.
One person died. That's like saying, oh, well, this swimming pool is safe to use because only one person died in it. Like, you'd be like, well, we should still investigate. I might not get in it. Like, what's in it? Is it poisoned? Like, what happened? Oh, well, you know, they jumped without looking and we took the water out. Okay, fine. So what can I do to make sure that doesn't happen to me? So yeah, I'm an anxious person. I was anyway before he died. I definitely was like a bit on that spectrum. You know, I was already there. And then the world gave me a really good reason to worry. So it's hard not to, but I am, thanks to therapy, getting better.
How do you think that this experience has impacted on your attitude to aging?
So it's dual. I wouldn't say I'm like super zen and like, oh, you know, who cares? As long as we're all here. Like, I still look in the mirror and think, oh God, like so grey and what should I do? And, you know, I still have those normal aging things where your body is not doing what you want it to do, and find that like difficult. But I do, as I said, I do find it difficult when people take it for granted, I guess, and say things like that, or, well, we could be dead tomorrow. Like, I used to have a friend who did sunbeds. She used to always say, well, we're all going to die anyway, so if I get skin cancer, you know. And I remember thinking, you have no idea what cancer looks like. Like, you, it's a phrase for you. And having seen someone die of cancer, you're like, it's nothing you would ever choose in a million years. It's like swallowing acid. And I used to find that really difficult, where people are flippant about it. It's weird. I've tried to work through this on therapy. therapy, I used to just feel like grateful for every single day. Every single day in my life. Like, okay, at least I'm here. And actually, even though that sounds very positive, it's not to live in a constant state of fear. So I try now to just be a little bit more relaxed about it. But I think it'll get harder as my kids get older, because at the moment they're young, and that's it. I had that childhood. But I think once they get past 15, I'll find it really like, I would like to get as far as that. Like, genuinely, that's something I've considered. It's like, it'd be good to get at least to 15. Because I did that and I was sort of all right. The maths you do with yourself, you know?
Yeah, Clover Stroud came on, and I think you've had her on Griefcast as well. And I mean, she didn't kind of call it that, but she was talking about the fact of her children getting older than she was when her mum had her accident, and then getting older than herself than her mum was when she had her accident. And she was just coming up to the point of getting older than Nell was when Nell died.
Yes, that's a really big thing with sibling loss, especially if the sister is older than you and you become older than the sibling, because it is a really like, well, that's not the law of the land. How does that make sense? Yeah, numbers are really important, and they shouldn't be, and all the logic in the world, it's just a number. What does it matter? But numbers really matter. And when I was younger, my dad died when he was 44, and I genuinely, when I was younger, thought, well, he was quite old. I was like, one of my thoughts to make myself feel better was like, he was old, and old people die. And obviously now I'm 40, I'm like, fucking hell, like, it wasn't old. But when you're 15, you're like, well, yeah, you know, they do die, and that does happen. You know, they are a bit decrepit at that age, and illness will get them. So it is a thing. It's definitely an awareness. It just brings an awareness. And that's what, coming back to what I've said before, grief is a lifelong process. You know, there's always something that you haven't quite been prepared for or considered, like you're turning your age, or the children being the age, or your friends turn the age, or your parent, you know, all of this stuff that you're like, oh yeah, okay, I'm nearly the age he was, so how would I have felt? I probably wouldn't wanted to talk about it either. I probably would act like that. And I, you know, you start slotting things in, and it can actually be very helpful. It can be very therapeutic and cathartic to allow yourself that. But it's also sad as ever. It's all of those things at the same time.
And there's a chapter at the end of the book, which is really, well, the whole book is really thought-provoking, but the chapter at the end of the book about thinking about your own mortality and like effectively planning your own death. And when I started to read it, I just thought, oh wow, I don't even, well, I need to read this, maybe I'll just stop here.
Skip.
I don't need to read this chapter. And then I read it, I was sitting in the cafe, and I came home and I said to my husband, do you want to be buried or scattered? And he was like, what? Where did that come from? So how do you, unless I know you're not an expert in this lived experience, and I get this all the time with people asking me advice about menopause, and I'm like, I'm not a doctor, I just know what I lived through. But how do you start those conversations without your partner thinking you've taken out life insurance?
What's so funny to me is, like, I can't believe, like, how long have you been married?
Like, nearly 30 years.
Yeah. And to me, it's like, it's incredible you haven't had that conversation, because someone who's obsessed with death in the way I am, that was an early conversation. Like, but I totally get that I'm odd and this is odd, but I always find it really amazing when I'm like, wow, did it come up?
We have had passing conversations, like in Paris, I think, because he said to me, oh, I thought you wanted to be scattered in Père Lachaise in Paris. I was like, well, yeah, I did. But now, no, not now.
So now you life changes. You've got to update them.
So what stage did you have that conversation with your husband?
Well, I'm in an unusual situation. So my dad obviously died when I was a teenager, and my husband lost both his parents, his dad when he was in his late 20s, his mum when he was mid 30s. So we literally have one grandparent between us, hence why we're very protective of her.
Oh God, yes, she's like very high value grand, isn't she?
Oh my God, it's like, you have to behave yourself.
No pressure,
And I went through those griefs. I was with him when his parents died, we were together. So I went through those processes and planned funerals and helped with that. So, you know, like, death has been a huge role and presence in my life, and not everybody has that experience, so I completely understand it. Just always, you know, it's like looking at through a neighbor's window and you're like, wow, look how they do the washing up. I didn't know you could do that. So obviously, since doing the podcast, I talk about death all the time, and I started interviewing, like, you know, people, more palliative care doctors and death doulas, and sort of exploring the other side of it rather than just people who've experienced grief. And that's when I sort of realised, like, I don't want to be like preachy, but like, it's sort of necessary to have these conversations. Mm. And the reason I would say that, even though they're hard, is I feel like it's future proofing. So the same way you might take out like home insurance, you know, and at the time it's boring, but when something happens, you're like, God, thank God we did that. That's so good. Mm. Because somebody will die. It's going to happen. Like, that's not shocking. It's true.
No,
it's true. Just we all know that.
Fact of life, yeah.
It's just, yeah, matter of luck and time. Who knows? You know, maybe you get lucky it's you and not them, but it's going to happen. And you're going to have to face all this admin or sadmin, as we jokingly call it in the community. And if you don't know for sure what someone wants, it can add like a thin extra sprinkling of sadness to the sadness. So you've already got the sadness of someone not being there. That's already shit. And then you have to plan a funeral, which you think, oh my God, we didn't even know. And I think it was this, but they said that 20 years ago about the parrot. Do we have to go to Paris? Do you think did she actually mean that?
Yeah.
Then we can't visit her. Like, oh my God, but you know, she said it. And one person will be like, she said it, she told me. And then the rest of you, if you have to disagree, thinking, oh my God, I think she changed her mind, but we're not sure. It's adding to this situation that's already shit. So why do that to your future self? Like, why not have the conversations now? So when it does happen, you're like, oh great, I can just deal with the grief, which is really hard. Like, that's so hard to deal with the grief. Why give yourself more? And you know, it comes back to what we said about negative emotions. Like, well, it will be hard to ask them. It'll be even harder when you're at a funeral director's home and they're saying, what did your husband want? You go, and then of course you feel like, oh my God, why? I should know this, all of this stuff. And of course, even if you haven't had the conversations, you can guess. And if you love someone, of course you'll probably guess correctly. And the reason I start with funerals is not that they're like mega, mega important. Like, they are a part of it, but it's just like, it's accepting someone's going to die and how are you going to process it, and sort of just opening that door in your relationship, but not necessarily partner, parents as well. There's lots of really good resources. There's my favorite is this book called The Death Book, which is made by the woman who makes those amazing space masks, which are like these like sleep eye masks. And she had a really, like, you put them on and they heat up and you have a lovely night's sleep.
Oh wow.
But she had a really difficult time. I think after one of her parents died, they didn't have any information, so she created this thing called the Death Book. It's a red book, like a notebook, a ring binder. I don't think it's even very expensive. And in it, it just says all the questions. Very cremated. What do you want read? And the idea is you just give it to someone or you buy it, you write everything down, and then you just say to someone, it's in that drawer. Done. So it doesn't have to be this intense, like, I know you will die and I want a perfect funeral. Just like, just so I know, how many bank accounts do you have? Is there a weird like password that I should know about, or is everything basically fine? You know, like, do you have life insurance? What do you want? Is there someone you don't want at your funeral? Actually, are you secretly religious and I had no idea? So it can open a lot of conversations that I think we're afraid to have. And I think it can just make the grief a bit easier. And my role, my self-appointed role, is to make the grief as easy as it can be, because it's so awful. I'm trying to make it as easy as it can be. And I'm telling you, after interviewing 200 people, there are two camps: the people who had everything sorted beforehand and the people who didn't. And the people who had everything sorted beforehand had, I'd say, let's call it 2.5% more of an easier time.
So because, like, we've got to put a number on it. Yeah.
Got to put a number on it so that I can sell it to you. So why not just give yourself 2.5%? Like, it's just so logical to me. But I know, yeah. I am practiced at these conversations. Like, I've learned over 6 years how to have these conversations. And it's not that I'm any better at them. I'm just better at being crap at them. That's all it is, because I've done it. In the same way that when you have a baby, like, you're not like instantly good at it. You get the hang of it, and then you realize, oh, this is just hard. I'm never really going to be brilliant. Some days are better, some days are not, and I do my best and they're sort of all right. Exactly the same with talking about grief and death. You just sort of realize sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't, but it's important to keep trying. That's it, really. It's actually very simple. So I think if you can, I would say start with funerals, because it's such a, you know, start with music. What music do you want at your funeral? Like, do you want a party afterwards? Like, who's not allowed to be there, or who do you like? Do you want a big picture of you, or you're not that bothered? Like,
yeah.
Stuff like that. And then you can move on to, if you have a serious accident, like, how do you feel about if you're in a vegetative state, you know, advanced care planning? I'm not saying jump in there first, because then they really will feel like, yeah, are you trying to kill me? But funerals are a really easy icebreaker to thinking about the unbearable.
What do you want played at yours?
I want, on the research for the book, I've discovered this banging funeral track called The Ways of Zion Do Mourn by Handel. And he wrote it for Queen Charlotte's funeral. Oh my God, it must be like, I don't know what it is, the 18th century equivalent of Robbie Williams' Angels. Like, it's just so funeral. And it's like this whole choral piece about Queen Charlotte dying. And it's like, she is gone, she is gone. And I heard it while I was writing the book. And I was like, yes, that is my funeral banger. Like, it's so dramatic, unnecessarily over the top. And I was like, I think that's quite fitting.
On that note, I'm going to ask you the questions I always ask at the end. What is your emotional age?
Oh, God.
Sorry.
How horribly revealing.
It feels a very loaded question in the light of this conversation. Sorry.
It's mixed. I'd say 15 is definitely a 15-year-old. I think I react to everything as a 15-year-old. And then I've learnt through therapy to go, now, hang on a minute. You're not 15. It's not that the world isn't fair. What is actually happening here? You don't have to be like, it's not fair. I didn't do it. It's not my fault. But that is definitely my automatic reaction.
I still do that. That's my automatic reaction too. Wasn't me.
It wasn't me. You can't blame me. Somehow this isn't my fault. And now I've learned to go, it might be your fault and that's okay. It's okay to do things wrong. But I definitely have to talk myself down off the 15-year-old tantrum.
Give us a book recommendation as well as the death book. So it can be anything. It can just be a book that you've always loved. It can be something great you read last week. Anything.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I have like an extensive grief library. I do one that I haven't mentioned for a while. It's a children's book and it's by Jade Perkin and it's called Mum's Jumper. And in the story, the little girl, her mum dies and she holds the jumper and it smells and it kind of gives her this like little way of getting through the initial grief. And Jade actually did an illustration for me at the back of the book. She designed my Griefcast podcast logo as well, and there's in the back there's a You Are Not Alone logo she designed, and she lost her mum. And I just find, even if you are not a child, I think Mum's Jumper will make you weep in a really healthy way. And if you do know someone who's a child who's been through anything like that, it's a really, really beautiful book. And there aren't many kids stuff that aren't extremely maudlin, I find, or like the bunny has died, which I just find a little bit tricky because it's not a bunny, is it? We're trying to tell someone that a human has died. Obviously some of the bunny books are great, but so Jade Perkin, Mum's Jumper. And then I'm in the middle of reading Vagabonds by Elagosa Osunde, which is magical realism in Lagos, which is so good. I'm really, really enjoying it because it's just like nothing I've ever read before. It's brilliant.
I'll check that out. I like a bit of magical realism. What advice would you give younger women?
Just hold on. It gets easier. And you look fucking great. That's right.
Oh,
you look so good. Just honestly, whatever in your head you think, you're incorrect. And in 10 years' time, you'll think, God, why didn't I appreciate that? So just whatever is complaining in your head, you're wrong. You're fundamentally wrong. I don't even need to see you. I know you look amazing. You look amazing. And yeah, hold on. It does get easier.
Brilliant. Have you got an old bird role model or an older woman who's inspired you?
There's lots of like cheesy ones. Well, they're all quite cheesy, aren't they? I guess. My mum is definitely a massive, massive, huge. What she went through when she was only 43, and then she went back to university having left school at 16 with like literally one O-level in sewing, and an art history degree at Goldsmiths, and having, you know, severe dyslexia that never been diagnosed properly and been told her whole life should basically...
Oh God, she's my old bird role model.
Yeah, she's amazing. She went back to uni and she got her life back and continued to look after me and my brother. So yeah, she's a pretty incredible person. So yeah. And then probably Stevie Nicks. Yeah. That's Stevie Nicks.
We've probably already covered this, but what's your superpower?
I think, well, I joke in the book, it is talking, and I know I talk an awful lot, but I have learned to accept that I am really good at talking things through, and I'm good at explaining things through talking. I actually find writing them down, like that was, it took me ages to get the talking to become words, which I think I did, but it was really, I love it. And if ever you need a natter about something, I'm here, especially if it's death.
I will totally take you up on that. Lastly, how many fucks do you give?
Oh my God, zero, none. And then sometimes too many, which I think, isn't that how we all feel? Mm. I absolutely couldn't give a fuck until, oh my God, there's so many fucks that I'm worrying about right now. So yeah, I definitely wouldn't say I've reached the balance of zero fucks, because I think that's the end game, isn't it? Yeah. It'd be boring if you'd got there already. I'm still working there.
I almost don't believe anyone who says zero, because like 999 out of 1,000 people say zero, and then they go, oh, but.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like, zero quite a lot of the time, and then quite a lot of the time, so many fucks that I'm like carrying around in a bag, being like, sorry about my fucks, I've got so many, I'm so sorry. Oh yeah. God, sorry, did they bump into you? I'm so sorry. Oh God, it's probably my fault. So yeah, it's a very healthy amount of fucks.
Oh, it's brilliant. Thank you so much. I've absolutely loved talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's been so nice to talk to you.
How was it being on the receiving end of the questions?
Really, really lovely. Honestly, you're an amazing interviewer. Like, genuinely, halfway through, I was like, oh, she's really good. I'm saying stuff I would never normally say. Like, how has she done that?
Thank you for listening. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to support The Shift further, please consider becoming a member of our community. Find out more at steady.media/theshift.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.